one of the things that I want to talk about this week has to do with covenants. We don't understand covenants. Now, in Abraham's time, everyone understood them. You know, you didn't need a lawyer back then to understand the legalese. Well, today we do need lawyers to help us understand, and this is a great frustration to people. So generally, we just ignore covenants and contracts. Consequently, people do not understand the language of covenants and contracts, and this means they don't understand their proper relationship to the Father, the Son, and the brethren. Today, we use language in our covenants and contracts instead of symbolism. But in the Bible, covenants with Jehovah are made using symbols first, then written language second. For instance, when we come to the place where the Lord tells Abram to look up into the sky and see how many descendants he will have, that is symbolism. When Yeshua walks through the pieces of the animals there in that covenant, there's very little written in the text. In fact, there's nothing written in the text on the meaning of that symbolism. The only thing that's written there is the result of that symbolism. Yet, that whole thing is symbolic because of those animals. And back in those days, in the ancient Near East, people understood what those symbols meant. But in our modern Greek mindset, we have two things against us. One, we don't understand the symbolism, as I just said. And two, we believe that there is only one correct interpretation of the symbols. But in Hebrew thinking, there are many aspects to the same symbol. For instance, symbolically, what might mean death to one is life to another. So that might be the way you could look at the covenant of the pieces. Death for one, life to another. But we'll get into that later on. Let's go to Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. Now, Jehovah tells Abraham to lech lecha in that verse. Lech lecha is lamed kof sofit. Lamed kof sofit with a dash. And it's related to the Hebrew word halak, which means walk. That is Strong's 1980, and it literally does mean to walk. So, Jehovah said to Abraham, walk from your father's house and from your birthplace. But notice that Jehovah did not say, go from your father's house to my house. This is because we have to first walk the walk. We don't just get to be in the Father's house until we have walked far enough with Him for Him to show us His house. Ultimately, that is the goal, to get to see Jehovah's house. But first we have to halak, or lech lecha, like Abraham did. We have to walk. And in the modern Hebrew, that word for our walk is halakha. You've probably heard that word before. The other thing that Jehovah did not tell Abraham to do was to bring his family. Now, we know Abraham did bring his family, but what we are learning here is that just like Abram's walk before Jehovah, our walk before Jehovah is personal. Other members of our physical family may or may not join in this walk with us, but ultimately the walk is ours to fulfill. This walk that Abram must do is our explanation of why our salvation, our opportunity to enter into Jehovah's house, is always set in the future. Our being saved at a future date will be dependent upon our continuing to walk. The debate about whether or not one can lose his salvation is actually a silly one, because our salvation doesn't come until the end. Before that, we're just walking, or, like Paul said, we're running the race. Where was Abraham going? He was going to go to a land that would be shown to him by Jehovah. Our salvation comes when we finish our walk to the land. So you see, the land is our destination. Salvation is our destination. The land and our salvation are tied up together. We don't get to inherit the land, and we don't get our salvation until the specified time, at the time of the resurrection. Along the way, we can stumble and fall and miss going to the land. That is the message about Moses, who did not get to go to the promised land. So it's all about the land and our relationship to it. Now let's take a look at the name of our patriarch. It's Abram. It's Strong's 87, and it means High Father. Abram, the original name of Abraham. This name is spelled Aleph Beit Resh Mem Sofit. Aleph has the meaning of strong, power, leader, and Beit means family, house. So those first two letters of Abram's name means father or Av. It's what we call Jehovah, our Father in heaven. And then the last two letters, the Resh and the Mem Sofit, mean elevation or height or high. That's why it says High Father in Strong's. So Resh is, he's the chief, he's the top, he's the beginning or the first of something. And the Mem is chaos, mighty, and blood. Now, as we are going to find out, Abraham is associated, or I should say Abram at this point, is associated with blood. But it's interesting that the early Semitic pictograph for this letter, Mem, is a picture of waves of water. So this pictograph has the meaning of liquid, water, sea, chaos from storms at sea. And so we have, though, another meaning for water, which is living water. The modern Hebrew name for this letter Mem probably came from the word mayim, meaning water, according to one source. So really, Abram is associated with the living water, Yeshua. So just in Abraham's name, we can determine his destiny. Now let's go to Genesis 12, verse 2. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. The reason for the walk that the Lord asked Abram to make was to make of Abram a great nation. You will recall that Abram walked for 25 years before the promised son was born. And then in verse 23 it says, And I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you, and in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. So here are the promises that Jehovah made to Abram in the first part of this Abrahamic covenant. Jehovah will show Abram a land. Notice that Jehovah did not say he would give Abraham or Abram the land. He, at this point, is going to show the land to Abram. Now, this is important because it will impact our understanding of the second part of this covenant that comes in chapter 15. And then next, Jehovah will make Abram into a great nation. Jehovah will bless Abram. And notice the blessings are not specific, but we assume these blessings include the land that Abram is at this point going to go take a look at. By the way, I believe that one of the reasons why the spies bringing back a bad report angered Jehovah so much was because it wasn't theirs to decide whether or not they wanted it. It was Abraham's to decide whether or not he wanted the land, but first he had to go look at it, which he is doing now here in chapter 12. And the next part of the covenant was Jehovah will make Abram's name great. Jehovah will make Abram a blessing. Jehovah will bless those that bless Abram. Jehovah will curse those that curse Abram. Jehovah will make all the families of the earth to be blessed through Abram. Now, right at this point, this is 8 promises that Jehovah has made to Abram in just the first part of the Abrahamic covenant. And yes, there is a reason I keep saying first part, and you'll understand this in a little while. So, Jehovah will do 8 things for Abram, and Abram's part is to just leave Ur and walk to the land that Jehovah wants to show him. Now, as you know, 8 is the number in the Gematria for new beginnings. Jehovah is about to begin a new part of the process of bringing the earth back into alignment with him for the purpose of setting up his kingdom here. Verse 4. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. And Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, into the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. Now, you know, back to the 10 spies. This is a similar report that the 10 spies had. There was someone else in the land. But we're going to see that this situation did not prevent Abram from believing that Jehovah owned that land and had the right to give it to him. You know, the Canaanites, they were called what we today would call squatters. They were squatting on the Lord's land. And it was this attitude of Abram that caused Jehovah to count it for righteousness in chapter 15 when the scripture says Abram believed Jehovah. Now, had the 10 spies had this same attitude, it would have been counted to them for righteousness. And not getting off too much on this rabbi trail, it was not necessary for the spies to be sent in the first place because the covenant was already made with their ancestor Abram long before they were even born, and they were bound to it by birth. Again, they had no right to decide on the matter, just like you and I have no say on where we will live in the kingdom. It will be Israel. This is why it is called the Promised Land. It comes to us as promised and not according to our personal opinion of it. Oh, and by the way, The promised land cannot be re-gifted, as is the new custom for unwanted gifts now, you know, like in the last few years when ungrateful recipients receive things they don't want, they just re-gift them. Yeah, we can't do that with Israel. Anyway, back to Genesis 12, verse 7. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, unto your seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar to the Lord who appeared to him. So this altar was built by Abram, and this altar is the sign to Jehovah from Abram, who is agreeing that now he's looked at the land, he sees that he likes this land, and he would like for it to belong to his descendants. This verse is the connecting verse to the second part of the Abrahamic covenant in chapter 15. But before we go to chapter 15, we have to go through some other things. First, Abraham began to have some situations and conditions occur as a result of his new life in the land. Genesis 12:8. And he removed from there to a mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east, and there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. After Abraham built that first altar, he went to Beit El, house of El. Hai is said by religious scholars and archaeologists to be actually Ai, where the first defeat of Israel happened after Joshua led the children of Israel into the promised land. Just a little trivial tidbit. Genesis 12:9, Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. So Abram left the land of Canaan and went to Egypt. Now, some people denigrate him for doing this, and also for some things that happened later, but perhaps we shouldn't do that. You see, at that time, Abram was not yet in possession of the land. He was still homeless and needed sustenance for his family and for all those who were with him. You know, when you buy a house, you go look at it, but you don't move into it until after the closing. This is the same thing here going on. He had to go somewhere in order to survive so that he could be the recipient of the land for his descendants. If he had stayed in Canaan, he may well have perished. So his decision to go to Egypt was most likely a wise one. Verse 11, and it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, behold now, I know you are a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see you, that they shall say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save you alive. Say, I pray you, you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and my soul shall live because of you. And it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he entreated Abram well for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say, she is my sister, so I might have taken her to me to wife? Now, therefore, behold your wife, take her and go your way. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that he had. Could this be another instance of denigration of Abraham or Abram, where none should exist? It is said that he threw Sarai under the bus and into the harem of the Egyptian pharaoh in order to save his own hide. Of course, we don't really know what was in Abram's heart, but let me suggest another reason for doing this. The first thing is, of course, that perhaps he understood that if Pharaoh killed him to get Sarai, he would have no heir to inherit the land that Jehovah had not yet given to him, but had only promised him. But Abram knew he had Jehovah's promise to do now 9 things. Remember, at first we counted 8, then one more was added to it, and that was the promise that the land would belong to Abram's heirs. So now we have 9 things that Jehovah has promised to Abram. I believe Abram didn't just start believing Jehovah in chapter 15 later on down the line. No, he believed Jehovah the minute he made plans to leave Ur, and now he would use those promises to his advantage. Abram knew Jehovah would not let anything happen to Sarai because Jehovah had told Abram he would curse anyone who cursed him. Now, yes, Abram could have waited to see if Pharaoh would try to take Sarai by force, but then we wouldn't have the prophecy. And what is the prophecy? Sarai, in this episode, represents the children of Israel who would be in the land under Pharaoh's thumb, having to be rescued by Jehovah, that's Abram in the prophecy, underneath the plagues. Remember when they came out of Egypt, they came out after there were plagues? Now, we may never know for sure, but I wonder if it is possible that Jehovah might have even put this in Abram's heart to do this. The text doesn't say so, but Jasher has some other details that does explain a lot, starting in Jasher chapter 15, verse 6. And Abram commanded the same to all those that came with him to Egypt on account of the famine, also his nephew Lot. He commanded, saying, "If the Egyptians ask you concerning Sarai, say, 'She is my sister, or the sister of Abram.'" And yet, with all these orders, Abram did not put confidence in them, but he took Sarai and placed her in a chest and concealed it amongst their vessels. For Abram was greatly concerned about Sarai on account of the wickedness of the Egyptians. And Abram and all belonging to him rose up from the brook Mitzrayim and came to Egypt. And they had scarcely entered the gates of the city when the guards came up to them, saying, "Give tithe to the king from what you have, and then you may come into the town." And Abram and those that were with him did so. And Abram, with the people that were with him, came to Egypt, and when they came, they brought the chest in which Sarai was concealed, and the Egyptians saw the chest. And the king's servants approached Abram, saying, "What have you here in this chest which we have not seen? Now open the chest and give tithe to the king of all that it contains." And Abram said, "This chest I will not open, but all you demand upon it I will give." And Pharaoh's officers answered Abram, saying, "It is a chest of precious stones. Give us the tenth thereof." Abram said, "All that you desire I will give you, but you must not open the chest." And the king's officers pressed Abram, and they reached the chest and opened it with force, and they saw, and behold, a beautiful woman was in the chest. And when the officers of the king beheld Sarai, they were struck with admiration at her beauty. And all the princes and servants of Pharaoh assembled to see Sarai, for she was very beautiful. And the king's officers ran and told Pharaoh all that they had seen, and they praised Sarai to the king, and Pharaoh ordered her to be brought, and the woman came before the king. And Pharaoh beheld Sarai, and she pleased him exceedingly, and he was struck with her beauty. And the king rejoiced greatly on her account, and made presents to those who brought him the tidings concerning her. And the woman was then brought to the Pharaoh's house, and Abram grieved on account of his wife, and he prayed to the Lord to deliver her from the hands of Pharaoh. So it turns out that Abram didn't just throw Sarai under Pharaoh's bus after all. She was first concealed, a prophecy about how Jehovah's people today are concealed and have been for millennia. Then she was made part of Pharaoh's household, or perhaps even his harem, like Esther. Then plagues came upon the Egyptians, like as at the first Pesach. And then in verse 17 of Jasher it says, "And Sarai also prayed at that time and said, O Lord God, you did tell me, my lord Abram, to go from his land and from his father's house to the land of Canaan, and you did promise to do well with him if he would perform your commands. Now behold, we have done that which you commanded us, and we left our land and our families, and we went to a strange land and to a people whom we have not known before." You see, Sarai did what the children of Israel would later do when they called out to Jehovah from their place in Goshen in Egypt. Verse 18, "And we came to this land to avoid the famine, and this evil accident has befallen me. Now therefore, O Lord God, deliver us and save us from the hand of this oppressor, and do well with me for the sake of your mercy." And the Lord hearkened to the voice of Sarai, and the Lord sent an angel to deliver Sarai from the power of Pharaoh. See, Sarah reminded Jehovah that they were in Egypt because of the famine, and they were having to deal with the famine because they had done what the Lord said to do. This is why Joseph was sent to Egypt, because of the coming famine. Remember, he said the Lord sent him down there, sold him into slavery for that reason. And ultimately, it was how the rest of the family wound up in Egypt. And what did Jehovah do for Sarai after this prayer? He sent an angel to deliver her, just as he later would do by sending Yeshua to be his strong right arm to redeem Sarai's own descendants from a pharaoh over 430 years later. Abram and Sarai were prophesying about the things that would happen to their descendants in the near future, the children of Israel in Egypt, and the far timeline, which is Esther in Babylon, and the very far future, which is us who are in captivity today. But the other thing that we must recognize here is that Jehovah got the opportunity to not only create a prophecy, but to prove to Abram that he would indeed bless those that bless him and curse those that curse him. So you see, there is much more to this account than we are usually taught. Now let's go to Genesis 13, verse 1. "And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south." Into the south of what? Well, into the south of the land. "And Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, to Bethel and Hai. unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first, and there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. You know, Abram went back to the land, to the altar that he had set up to Jehovah in the beginning, and he called upon the Lord there. Now, this was not intended to tell us that his calling upon the Lord was a one-time thing. No, this is where Abram regularly called upon the Lord. How do I know that? Well, the text immediately jumps into a conflict between him and Lot. And if you will stay with me, you'll see why I say the Lord regularly called upon the Lord. Let's go to verse 5. And Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents, and the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. Now let's skip down to Genesis 13, verse 14, for right now. And the Lord said to Abram, After that Lot was separated from him, lift up now your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see, to you will I give it and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall your seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, for I will give it to you. And Abram removed his tent, and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and he built there an altar to the Lord. So you see, right after the conflict with Lot was resolved, the Lord spoke to Abram. Why? Because Abram had been calling upon the Lord at the altar he set up. That altar was Abram's symbolic language to the Lord that he was interested in the Lord's proposal. So when did the Lord speak to Abram? Well, probably when he was at the altar, calling upon the Lord. Now, there will be some who say, I am reading too much into the text. Maybe I am. You decide. Remember, nothing that any teacher says to you is for you to just take at face value. You have to do the study to show yourself approved. Just always remember that. Don't take what I say for granted. You study it out for yourself. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this next part, but the events from Genesis chapter 14, verses 1 to 17 are, I believe, prophetic of wars to come. We see already in Genesis 13 that Abram's house became split over a dispute, just like the two houses of Judah and Israel later would. Now, this war in Genesis 14 with many regional kings has much prophetic significance throughout the history of the Hebrews right on down to our time, but I want to draw your attention to Genesis 14:14, because there has been a war and Lot has been taken captive, and in verse 14 it says, when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. Wait a minute. Lot was Abram's nephew, not his brother. We already know that. So why does the Bible call Lot Abram's brother? Because this is covenant language. Abram was in covenant from Genesis 12:1 with Jehovah to come out of Ur. Lot came out with him, which is the same thing as Lot saying he wants to be in covenant with Jehovah too. So while the physical relationship is one of uncle and nephew, the spiritual relationship is a parity covenant relationship. What is a parity covenant? It is a covenant between equals before the eyes of their king. The reason that I can call folks brother and sister who are no physical relation to me is because we are in covenant vertically with Yeshua, the vassal of the Father. So we are in parity or equal covenant with each other. So the covenant language then is the basis of all the relationships in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. Let me explain this to you. If you don't understand covenant language, you won't have a complete or deep understanding of relationships in the Bible. So just remember, all believers are in parity covenant with each other. We're all equal. No one is greater. No one is lesser. Now let's look at verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him, Abram, and said, Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand, and he, Abram, gave him, Melchizedek, tithes of all. Now, this is where I believe Abram became a priest in the order of Melchizedek, and something else that I'm going to explain to you. This is my opinion. I think this is important to our understanding of this three-part covenant in Lech Lecha, you know, being willing to serve under the high priest, Yeshua, who was not called Yeshua at the time, he was called Melchizedek, is a requirement for being able to live in the land. The priests, the sons of Zadok, and the bride are the same entity. They go to live in the land. In fact, when the children of Israel came to Mount Sinai, it was for the purpose of making them into a nation of priests that would live in the land. Now, they failed their ordination, so Jehovah created a substitute priesthood with the Levites. That's because if you're going to live in the land, there has to be a priesthood there. But it is my personal belief, and you can agree or disagree with me, it's my personal belief that the only inhabitants of the land of Israel during the millennial kingdom will be those who are priests or who are the bride. See, the land is her dowry. It's her inheritance. And a bride's inheritance never belongs to the rest of the people in her family. So the rest of the people in the family will be in the kingdom, but they will not necessarily live in the land. And I believe this is what it means when those folks come knocking on Yeshua's door saying, Lord, Lord, and he cast them into outer darkness. We're all familiar with that scripture. Outer darkness means outside the land. It's not outer darkness as in forever lasting punishment as we have, some of us have been taught in the past. So outer darkness means outside the land. In the kingdom? Yes. In Israel? No. The kingdom will be on the earth. The whole earth will be the kingdom, but the capital is going to be in Israel. So it was after Abram became a priest in the order of Melchizedek that the next part of the covenant was made with him. And this is important. Abram had to prove himself in a way that none of the rest of us have to. He had to prove his walk before the Lord in order for the fulfillment of the promise to move forward. It wasn't until after Abram had been walking with the Lord for a while that Jehovah finally progressed with the royal grant covenant in chapter 15. We, on the other hand, get to be recipients and inheritors of this land, along with all of the other benefits of joining into the covenant with Jehovah right away. As soon as we accept the terms of the covenant, we are considered inheritors because of our forefather Abram walking correctly before the Lord. Now, we just have to walk as Abram walked after we accept the covenant, because we can disqualify ourselves just like the house of Israel did, who found herself outside the land by divorce. So we have to take this relationship, this covenant agreement we make, seriously in order to continue our qualification to and obtain the land, our salvation, and our destination. Genesis 14:21. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons and take the goods to yourself." And Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted up my hand to the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth." We just read that language up here in the story with him and Melchizedek in verse 19. Keep that in mind. And he says, "I will not take a thread, even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich,' save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion." Why did Abram reject the king of Sodom's offer? Did Abram just not like the king of Sodom? Well, I believe Abram's reaction has to do with his encounter with Melchizedek. When Abram was with Melchizedek, I believe that when he raised his hand to the Most High God who possesses the heaven and the earth, that he was coming into a suzerain covenant with the Most High God. And Melchizedek was the vassal. See, you have the king, the Most High God, then you have the vassal. Sometimes we call him the king, sometimes we call him prince. He's also called the vassal. That's Melchizedek in Genesis. It's Yeshua to us now. But this falls in line with my belief that Abram was ordained into the order of Melchizedek at that time. In verse 22, Abram said he has already lifted up his hands to Jehovah. Remember, verse 19 is when he said that. Then in verses 23 and 24, he explains that he won't take anything from anyone because it might cause that person to say he is the one who has enriched Abram and not Jehovah. By vowing this oath, Abram is telling the king of Sodom that he belongs to the king of Salem, Melchizedek. He belongs to Jehovah, the king over Melchizedek, meaning he is now in the line of succession. What is the line of succession? It's the suzerain line. As I just explained, the father is the king, Melchizedek, who later became known as Yeshua, through his earthly life, is the vassal of the father, who is king of all. Abram had already been a servant of Jehovah, but now he is more than that. He is both a priest and a bondservant of the vassal at this point. In fact, the fact that Abram paid tithes to Melchizedek proves that Abram became a vassal of Melchizedek. Now, tithes were forced upon him to be paid in Egypt. But remember, I just said they were forced upon him to be paid in Egypt. He did not willingly come into covenant with that Pharaoh in Egypt, because one does not pay tithes to anyone willingly. but one's Lord, the party that rules over you. You see? So in this case, it was Melchizedek who was the one that Abram willingly paid tithes to, who was the earthly representative of the Most High, Jehovah. The king of Sodom was trying to get into a covenant with Abram, and Abraham said that he was not going to do it. That's what was going on there. Now, there is no place in the text except here in verse 19 where it says that Abram raised his arm. So that's where he took the oath to be a priest and to be in the suzerain covenant. Okay, now chapter 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram. I am your shield and your exceeding great reward." And I happen to like the wording in the translation called The Scriptures, 1998, which says, "After these events, the word of Jehovah came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward is exceedingly great.'" There is a subtle difference there, but ultimately, what we're going to be looking at here is the Hebrew word for reward, and that is sakar. That word is Strong's 7939, and it means literally payment of a contract. And so, it has some other meanings too, like compensation and benefit. But what we are getting here in verse 1 is that Jehovah has just hinted at what he is about to do with Abram. Jehovah is about to enter into a covenant where he will be the reward. He will pay the contract. And paying that contract, sakar, or paying that covenant, I don't like that word contract in terms of biblical things. Paying that covenant is a vital part of understanding what's going to happen in chapter 15. Verse 2, "And Abram said, 'Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus?' And Abraham said, 'Behold, to me you have given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is my heir.'" It appears that Abraham was looking at his situation with natural eyes, but what Abraham is really doing here is reminding Jehovah that one of the blessings in the first part of this covenant that was made when he left Ur was that he would become a great nation. According to the covenant, it was up to the giver of the covenant to fulfill all 9 blessings that were given. So Abram is putting it back on Jehovah. Verse 4, "And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, 'This shall not be your heir, but he that shall come forth out of your own bowels shall be your heir.' And he brought him forth abroad and said, 'Look now toward heaven and tell the stars, if you be able to number them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your seed be.' And he believed in the Lord, and he," Jehovah, "counted it to him," Abram, "for righteousness." Walking by faith is not what we're talking about here in verse 6. We're not talking about that continual walk that has to do with consistency continually. We're talking about a word that is aman in Hebrew, and it is Strong's 5:3-9. And it means to build up or support, or figuratively to render firm or faithful, to trust or believe. The fruit of walking by faith in Abraham's life had already become evident, because Abraham had already obeyed Jehovah to leave Ur. But this Aman, this particular thing that happened to him, this belief, this thing happened in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, when Jehovah saw that Abram would once again obey, because Jehovah knew there was a history of obedience with Abram. The Lord counts this kind of righteousness to us too, after we walk for a while, and he sees what's in our heart. So when Abram heard that he would have an heir that would come from his own body, his heart had a positive reaction. And the Lord knows the heart. So this was a heart thing, because there was no lag time between this and the rest of the story where Abram would have had enough time to further walk in faith. No, the Lord was relying on Abram's past history of obedience and the instantaneous reaction of his heart, which was aman. It was belief. The reason we know that Jehovah was depending on Abram's obedience to come out of Ur, and that is the reason he counted Abram's heart reaction of belief as righteousness, is in the very next verse, verse 7. And he said to him, I, the Lord, brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit it. See, Jehovah is referencing Abram's former obedience. And now, because of that obedience, the announcement comes that Abram will receive the land that Jehovah promised to show him when he was still in Ur. But the time finally came that Abram has asked Jehovah for evidence of the first part of the three-part covenant. Now, we're going to go down a little rabbi trail here. Defining the covenant this way, I'm going to tell you right now, is controversial. Some may say that only the covenant in chapter 15 is the Abrahamic covenant, or that only the part in chapter 17 where the circumcision requirement is given and obeyed is the Abrahamic covenant. But my question is, who was party to all of these covenants? Abram. Each one, starting with the first one in chapter 12, can be called part of the Abrahamic covenant. And we can try to see them separately and get ourselves all confused, or we can see them as clauses. Like clauses of a contract, these are clauses of a greater covenant, and I'm going to suggest to you here in just a few minutes that even the Mosaic covenant is a clause of this greater Abrahamic covenant. Now hang in here with me, because I will provide more explanation on this, and then you can study it out and decide for yourself. So, okay. Back to Abraham finally asking for proof, after walking with the Lord for a very long time already, just relying on the first part of this three-part covenant, Abram finally says, hey, wait a minute. How can I be assured that you're going to do what you said in, you know, giving him an heir of his own body? That you will make my descendants to be as the stars of the heaven. After all, here I am in a strange country, away from my land, away from my family, as you asked, and you haven't given me the land that you showed me yet. Well, as it turns out, that was not only a good question, but it was the right question. Sometimes it helps to ask the right question. Let's go to Genesis 15, verse 8. And he said, Lord God, where shall I know, or whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And he said unto him, take me a heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he took unto him all these, and divided them in the midst, or in the middle. He split them down the middle, and laid each piece one against another. But the birds divided he not. And when the fowls came upon the carcasses, Abram drove them away. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he, Jehovah, said to Abram, Know of a surety that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Now, wait a minute. We're trying to get to how we're going to know that we have an heir of our own body. And now the Lord tells us that he's going to have our seed be a stranger in a land that is not theirs. Why does the Lord start out telling him about the first captivity of the descendants? Because they won't actually possess the land until after that captivity. Verse 14, And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. The curses of the first part of this three-part covenant will come into play in that future time. Verse 15, And you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. Don't worry, Abram. Everything is going to be okay. And then in verse 16 it says, But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. What is that talking about? Well, the Amorites were descendants of Canaan, the son of Ham, the son of Noah. And from what I can gather online, the Amorites were actually invading the area that we now know as Syria and Iraq. So their invasion was not yet complete. Their iniquity, their perversity and mischief is what the Hebrew word avon means. That was not over yet. And apparently, Jehovah wanted that to get done and be over with for perhaps some other prophetic purpose that I don't see at this point. But now we come to the royal grant covenant. Abram has already treated with Jehovah as part of the suzerain covenant by finishing up that process from chapter 12 with Melchizedek. Remember, this royal grant of land is also sometimes called a land covenant. It is taught that the royal grant treaty is an unconditional covenant. It's taught that the royal grant treaty is an unconditional covenant, but I believe that it is not unconditional, but rather irrevocable. It turns out that the Mosaic covenant makes this royal grant treaty, this land covenant, conditional upon the behavior of the descendants of Abraham. I'm going to get to that in a little bit later. Let's go to verse 17. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto your seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Do you see that the recipients of this royal grant or land grant is not for Abram, but for his descendants? We need to understand why this covenant is irrevocable, but not unconditional. Hang in here with me and I will show it to you, and then you can study it out and decide for yourself. This is a subtle but very important difference between being irrevocable and unconditional. And then now let's just finish out chapter 15. The Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and Perizzites and Raphaims and the Amorites and the Canaanites, the Girgashites and the Jebusites. So now, Jehovah has just told Abram the boundaries of the land in that what I was just reading to you. In fact, in order for the descendants to claim the land, they have to walk it. We've read a couple of times in this Torah portion where the Lord said for Abram to go walk it, but Abram just kind of went over here to like the land, you know, Mamre and pitched his tent. He really didn't go walk the land. This is why the Israelites had to walk the land when they took possession of it. Deuteronomy 11:24. Every place whereon the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours. From the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even to the uttermost sea shall your coast be. But notice that they did not walk it or take possession of it until they agreed to be bound by the rules of the kingdom as given by Moses. Now, we call this the Mosaic Covenant, but I believe this Mosaic Covenant is actually a clause and is part of the Abrahamic Covenant, and that this is what makes the Abrahamic Covenant, this the second portion given here in Genesis 15, conditional upon their behavior in order for them to stay in the land. Now stay with me. In verse 12, we learn that Abram was put to sleep by Jehovah, and then Jehovah, which is Yeshua, walked through the pieces for himself. And then he walked through the pieces on behalf of Abram. This made the land grant irrevocable. In other words, no matter what the children of Israel do, the finality of it will be that they will inherit that land. And as a matter of fact, I have in other Torah portions mentioned how Ezekiel and some of the other prophets talk about how the Lord is going to bring them back with his arm his arm out and with wrath and fury poured out, because apparently he's bringing them back to the land kicking and screaming. This irrevocable covenant says that if Jehovah fails to keep his part by giving the land in perpetuity to Abraham's descendants, may Jehovah be flayed open like those animals. Now, all covenants come with elements that make it legal. Those elements have to be present in the covenant or in a contract to make it legal, to make it enforceable in a court of law. Now, in our modern day contracts, some of these elements are, there has to be at least two parties named, the duties of each party must be delineated, punishment for violation of the contract must be set forth, and there must be consideration, or another term for consideration is an exchange of something of value. Usually that means we give them money. These are just some of the elements of our modern contracts, but you get the idea. The same thing applies in biblical covenants. The two parties have to be named. Goods and or services and gifts, if any, must be specified. All covenants come with punishments for violating the covenant, and there must be an exchange of value. In the first part of this covenant, in Genesis 12, among other things, comes blessings and curses. You know, blessings and curses are the same thing as the valuable goods the recipient will receive in exchange for something of value. In this case, it's Abraham's obedience. The curses are the punishment for the recipient or the giver or whichever party violates the terms of that agreement. In Genesis 15, it appears that there are blessings and no curses. But this is a misunderstanding of the text, because the symbolism of the animals lying dead in two pieces split apart speaks more volumes than any amount of text can describe. Those animals being there like that says that if Jehovah violates the covenant, may he be flayed open like those animals. And because Yeshua walked through the pieces on behalf of Abram's descendants, he was saying, if those descendants violate this covenant, may I be flayed open like these animals. In other words, Yeshua took a death penalty upon himself for any future violations. Now let me clear something up here. This covenant cannot be broken because Jehovah is one party to it. That is what makes it irrevocable. However, it can be violated, resulting in the death of the one who said he would pay that penalty. To understand the conditions that make the covenant violable, we have to wait until Yeshua redeems the children of Israel out of Egypt and is trying to take them to the land before we learn what those conditions are. I believe, along with Rico Cortez, who showed me this, that Moses connected part 2 of the Abrahamic covenant to the behavior of the children of Israel, and this happened in Exodus 24. Let's go over there to Exodus 24 and start in verse 3. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said will we do. The children of Israel in this verse said, all the words which the Lord has said will we do, which is an agreement to the Mosaic clause of the Abrahamic covenant. Verse 4, and Moses wrote all the words of the Lord and rose up early in the morning and built an altar under the hill and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. What was Moses doing here? I believe, like Rico, that he was symbolically starting to reenact Genesis 15, and he is tying the Mosaic clause of the Abrahamic covenant to that royal land grant. This is what made the second part of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 15 conditional, because look what he did in verse 7. He took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient. What book of what covenant? We've never heard of this one before, have we? What was the covenant that came before this? The Abrahamic covenant. Is it a stretch of the imagination that Abraham recorded and passed down in writing the terms of all the clauses having to do with the Abrahamic covenant, and now Moses has this book? Some might say that the book of the covenant has to do with Abraham's purchase of the cave at Machpelah. But that doesn't make sense, does it? The children of Israel were going to get much more land than the cave at Machpelah. Now, look what Moses does in verse 8. And Moses took the blood. Remember, he had some in basins, and he put blood in basins, and he sprinkled some on the altar. Look what he does now. He sprinkles it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you concerning all these words." You see, what covenant is he talking about here? Well, he's talking about the Mosaic clause of the covenant of Abraham that he just read to them from the book of the covenant. And here is the rest of the reenactment of Genesis 15, the clause, Genesis 15, of the Abrahamic covenant. The blood has already been sprinkled on that altar, as I just got done saying, but that is indicating that Yehovah owns the land. When Moses sprinkled that blood on that altar, he was saying, "Oh, Yehovah owns this land." And now the blood has been sprinkled on the people who are going to go inhabit that land. So now the Genesis 15 clause of the Abrahamic covenant has become conditional. And in verse 9 it says, "Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel." They were going up to the wedding supper after that, because this was the covenant where they got the ketubah and they became Yeshua's bride. They became his wife. They married him. But now you know why Yeshua was required to die. The house of Israel violated the conditional covenant, the Mosaic clause of the Abrahamic covenant, and had to be kicked out of the land for their idolatry. Yehovah allowed them to stay in the land for hundreds of years doing what they did, hoping that they would return to him. But after a while, he made the decision to remove them from the land. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 6. "The Lord said also to me in the days of Josiah the king, 'Have you not seen that which backsliding Israel has done? She has gone upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there has played the harlot.' And I said, after she had done all these things, 'Turn you to me.' But she returned not, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw, when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. But the house of Israel failed to live up to the requirements in the Mosaic clause of the Abrahamic covenant. So in order to fulfill the requirement for the violation in the royal land grant covenant, Yeshua had to die on behalf of the house of Israel. Here's another tidbit from Rico Cortez to me, and then from me to you. Why did Yeshua die between two men? And why do believers make such a big deal out of it? I believe, as does Rico, that Yeshua's death between two bodies of flesh was symbolic of him walking through those pieces in Genesis 15. Another important part of the story is in chapter 16, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but there are details in here that I need you to pay attention to, because they do impact the reason why the Lord made this covenant in clauses. In other words, there's part 1, part 2, part 3, and then part 4, which is the Mosaic covenant, is right here in chapter 16. It's because Abram and Sarah got ahead of themselves and they gave Abram a descendant who was the descendant of his flesh and not the proper descendant. So let's go on then to chapter 17, and we're going to find out how the Lord was going to specify Abraham getting a descendant. Verse 1, and when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be you perfect, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. Now, this is where he's going to tell Abram that there has to be circumcision. But before he does that, he actually changes Abram's name from Abram to Abraham. And the reason that he did that is because he said that he was going to make his name great. Well, what that means is he put the hay in Abram's name, and that hay is the breath of the Ruach. It also stands for God's glory. So that is how the Lord made his name great. The other thing that we see here in verse 1 is that the Lord commanded Abram to be tamim, perfect. And if you will remember from Noah, I said that was the word that the Lord used for Noah, that he was tamim. What that means is he was without spot and without blemish. You can go and take a look at that word. It's Strong's 8549. And so the Lord was telling Abram to present himself as a spotless, blemishless bride. And down here in verse 10 is where we get to the circumcision. It says, this is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your seed after you. Every man-child among you shall be circumcised. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant between me and you. This is a token of what covenant? It's the token of the covenant in Genesis 15. It's a token. This is another thing that makes Genesis 15 covenant conditional. Because if you don't circumcise yourself, if you don't circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and we find out later on your heart, then you can't be part of this covenant. This is a token of that covenant. So Abraham circumcised himself and all the people of his household, all the men of his household. Now, I've got a friend that I midrashed with this about. Her name is Teresa, and she's put this in such a way as I just thought it was really wonderful. I couldn't have said it better. She said that Yeshua, when he walked through those pieces, I told you there's more than one way to look at walking through those pieces. Look, he walked through those pieces and it represents death, but he walked through those pieces and it represented him as the seed that would be born, that came between the cutting of the flesh of Abraham's skin, the circumcised skin. Yeshua was representing himself in both of those ways, because he knew that he was going to have to die to fulfill the requirement of the violation that would come. You know, only the Lord could set up a plan this beautifully and this wonderfully, right? So in chapter 17, we have another clause, or part 3 of the Abrahamic covenant, where Abraham cut himself and Abraham's cutting was symbolically related to those split animal pieces, and it created a condition upon the royal land grant hundreds of years before Moses joined the children of Israel to that covenant. So, right up front, this Abrahamic covenant is conditional, but it is irrevocable. It cannot be revoked. Thus, the seed that came through Abraham's cutting was the one that walked through the pieces almost 4,000 years later. And the first generation of that seed was Isaac. Putting this circumcision requirement in there made the Abrahamic covenant conditional in all of its part. And that was done so Jehovah would have the right to specify the kind of heirs he would allow to inherit the land. As long as we maintain that there is no connection between Yeshua walking through those pieces and his subsequent crucifixion, then we are agreeing that it doesn't matter whether or not you are willing to obey Jehovah, and furthermore, this understanding allows for physical firstborns, firstborns of the flesh, Ishmael, to inherit the land. This is why in chapter 17, Jehovah comes back to Abram to make this other covenant. Can you imagine what would have happened if the Lord had just, you know, in the very beginning there in chapter 12, if he had just come to and said, well, I'm going to do these nine things. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to make your descendants like the stars of the heaven, and I'm going to put you to sleep now, Abram, and I'm going to show you this fearful sight, and as soon as we're done with this, you're getting circumcised. Can you imagine the impact that would have had on Abram? Is our God not merciful? See, the Lord had to do this in stages. He had to do this over a period of time in order to make it work and to have everything come out the way it would, because definitely we would not have wanted Ishmael to have been the heir to that land, would we? But you see, God is smarter than we are. He knew what was going to happen, and so he waited to complete the covenant in sequences. So you might say that Jehovah could have just let Isaac be the firstborn, right? You could say that. And then that would do away with the argument that I'm making with you right now. But if the Lord had done that, he would have broken the already established pattern that teaches us that it is not the natural firstborn that inherits the blessing, but spiritual firstborns who come through that cutting. So you see why Jehovah made this Abrahamic covenant in parts or clauses, as I say, and you can now see why the whole thing is conditional. Let me further explain this in terms that most people today can identify with. Let's take a look at a basic real estate transaction, because that's what this is. It's a land grant. It's inheriting the land. In Genesis 12, the Lord offers land to Abraham. That's like when, you know, you're walking by, your neighbor's property, and he comes out the door and he says, hey, would you like to have this property? And you look at it. Abraham looked at the land, and Abraham said, I like it. You say, I like it. And now we're going to have a closing, because we've had the showing, and we now have the contract where, you know, like where Abraham built the altar to let the Lord know he liked the property. We have said, yes, I like it, and we have made the contract and given the earnest money. So now we're at the closing table, and out comes the deed of trust. This is what we call a mortgage today, but it only in this particular deed of trust here in the Bible, not only is the seller giving you the land, but he's also going to pay for it. Remember, Sakar, the reward. What a deal that would be, huh? All the terms and conditions of the deed of trust are laid out in that document. This is what happened in Genesis 15. Okay, we got the land from the seller, or the giver in this case. But then comes the warranty deed, which is the part where you do something. In a warranty deed, as in the case of circumcision and a Mosaic clause, you are guaranteeing for due consideration or payment, in our case that's obedience, that the land will be used only for a particular purpose. Get your warranty deed out sometime and look at it. It specifies the proper use of the property. Now, we say, well, that's what the CC&Rs, the covenant conditions and restrictions, are for. But no, that warranty deed specifies that this property is a certain kind of property, and that's what its use is. And that's what Jehovah is doing here with circumcision, with this circumcision clause of the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic clause of the Abrahamic covenant. He is specifying who can inherit the land, and he's telling them what the proper use of the land is. Not just anyone gets to use that property. You have to be someone who is willing to get circumcised and walk like Abraham. Being circumcised is the symbolism for the words, "You are my king, I am your servant, and we are in a legally binding covenant." That's what circumcision is symbolic of. If you say those words, but you don't circumcise yourself or allow the Ruach to circumcise you, you're not in the covenant. So the sign of obedience to the conditions of the Mosaic clause of the Abrahamic covenant is keeping the Sabbaths, plural. Believers don't understand the legal and binding agreement that they are part of. Ultimately, all of the parts, the clauses of the Abrahamic covenant, including the royal land grant clause, the circumcision clause, and the Mosaic clause, are tied together. Well, I hope that this teaching has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.